Welcome to Component 4, Introduction to Information and Computer Science. This is Unit 8, Security. The objectives of this unit include gaining the ability to list and describe common security concerns. Describe safeguards against common security concerns, including firewalls, encryption, virus protection software and patterns, and programming for security. Describe security concerns for wireless networks and how to address them. List security concerns and regulations that relate to healthcare applications. And finally, describe security safeguards used for healthcare applications. It seems appropriate to begin our discussion with inquiring why we should be concerned about the security of our computers, our data, and our networks at all. The potential for lost, stolen, or compromised data is a real concern. When data has been compromised, somebody has seen information they should not have seen, or somebody has accessed information and then made unauthorized changes to it. Identity theft and impersonation are also significant concerns. For example, somebody could steal your identity and then impersonate you by using your credit card. Network security and data security breaches can also lead to business downtime. If a company's website, such as Google, Amazon, or eBay, were not secure, think of the ramifications of a shutdown of their websites for part or all of a business day. Consider the financial repercussions for that business and to their customers. Lastly, consider blackmail. Confidential personal data that is not secure may end up in the wrong hands, leading to threats of disclosure unless certain actions are taken, like paying large sums of money to the person who wrongly accessed the data, for instance. Common threats to security include malware, which is defined on this slide. According to Wikipedia, malware, which is short for malicious software, is software designed to infiltrate a computer system without the owner's informed consent. You most likely know how this occurs through experience or indirect experience. You may have inadvertently clicked on a file which in turn forces an installation program to launch and install something on your computer. Although you didn't approve the installation, it just installed anyway. Or maybe you have visited a web page and clicked on a link or button on the page that automatically installed software on your computer. All of us find this very frustrating and must be aware and mindful when we open attachments to emails, open files, and click on items on various websites. Types of malware include trojans, viruses, hoaxes, worms, phishing attacks, macroviruses, and hackers. Let's examine each of these in the following slides. A Trojan horse is a malware program that usually impersonates a known good file installed on your computer, where the Trojan horse replaces the known good file with itself. This is more difficult to do with critical updates and the built-in security measures implemented in Windows operating systems, but it still happens. The Trojan horse gets its name from the Greek Trojan horse myth. The Trojan does its dirty work on a certain date through a user action or even on command. You have probably heard stories of hackers creating programs, installing them on computers, and then waiting for a date or a certain event to occur. When that date or event comes to pass, the program launches itself and then destroys certain files on the computer, or even all of the files that are on the computer. Trojans can destroy or copy data, install adware and other programs, or even install a browser toolbar. They can also record keyboard keystrokes and send this information to an attacker, who can later use the information to further scam and attack a computer or person. Lastly, Trojans can scan computer ports. Computer ports can be likened to telephone extensions on a phone system. A computer provides thousands of ports for communication purposes. Ports are used by browsers, installed applications, and the operating system for communication purposes. A Trojan can scan a communication port, look for information to pass through the port, and then send that information to an attacker. A virus is a computer program that can harm a computer and make it inoperable. Indeed, some viruses disable important operating system functionality, such as the ability to back up a hard disk. Some viruses will even work to reformat a hard disk. Some viruses are only an annoyance and usually don't make copies of themselves on other computers. They just act. Removing a virus usually cleans the computer, assuming it is the only virus on the computer. However, some viruses do make copies of themselves, and if the copy of the virus is removed, the remaining copy replaces the removed virus, making it difficult to clean the system. Often the best response is to format the hard disk and reinstall the operating system, or restore from a virus-free backup. Sending a virus by an email usually does replicate the virus because all it takes is for someone to click on an email to give it focus, which can launch the virus's program code. In 2008, the fun.exe virus spread itself via email throughout the world and was very difficult to remove as it made millions of copies of itself on infected computers. Macroviruses usually infect Microsoft Office files and install themselves when users click or give focus to Microsoft Office files. A macro is a small program which is usually written in Visual Basic for applications, known as VBA. In fact, all Microsoft Office files have the ability to have VBA code written inside of them for functionality. VBA code in itself isn't harmful. It's the people who write programs for bad purposes who can cause harm. Macroviruses, as mentioned previously, spread when users click files in which the macrovirus resides. Note that most people would be totally unaware that a virus is inside of a file because its actions are silent. Clicking on an infected file typically provides no immediate indication that something bad has launched. Macroviruses may also delete files and disable Windows functionality on an infected system. Again, it is important to be aware of the risks when you receive files and/or emails. If you do not know the sender or are not sure you can trust the sender, it is best to not even click on the email and attachment because that simple act will give it the focus needed to do harm. Some email programs quarantine suspicious email, preventing it from doing harm to the system, regardless of whether you click the email or not. Personal information attacks are accomplished through an activity called phishing. Though it is pronounced like the word phishing, it is spelled with a PH rather than F. Phishing is an attempt to trick you into revealing personal information to an attacker so that they can impersonate you. The attacker fishes for information about you. For example, you might receive an email that appears to be from your bank, eBay, or even Amazon, asking you to log in to verify a transaction or to verify your username and password. You should never respond to such an email request. Your bank or financial institution, indeed any reputable internet merchant, would never send an email asking you to do that. So, if you receive an email of that sort, you should contact the institution being impersonated and report the incident immediately so they may investigate. In fact, when you click a link that appears in a phishing email, the website that opens looks as you would expect it to. For example, if it came from your bank, the website that appears looks mostly like your bank's website. But if you carefully examine the email and website, you can often spot spelling errors or slight variations in colors, alerting you to the fact that this might be an attack and not an authentic communication. Most email software, such as Microsoft Outlook, includes the ability to monitor for phishing activity and then move the suspected email to a functional folder called junk email. The email is quarantined and isolated from the rest of the computer system and is not actionable as long as it remains in the junk email folder. Be wary of moving email from the junk email folder to your inbox because doing so takes it out of quarantine. A worm is a program that works to create a lot of network traffic. Note that some worms are not malware, but are put in place by network administrators to crawl the network, searching for information, and to report activity. Worms that are malware, though, usually work to replicate themselves, and they make the network unusable by continuously putting excess traffic on the network. You can liken this to every person in a large city leaving work at 5 o'clock p.m. and immediately jumping in their cars and getting on the same highway. That is essentially what a worm does. An example of a notorious malware worm is the I Love You worm. In May of 2000, the I Love You worm successfully attacked millions of computers. When users clicked an email attachment called I Love You, the worm made copies of itself and sent the copies to every contact that was in each email recipient's email contact list. Hoaxes are usually harmless attempts to convince you of something that is not true. They usually come to you in the form of an email. Some hoaxes, which are harmful, invite you to send money to someone in another part of the world. Others ask you to contribute to find missing children. In some cases, emails requesting funds for missing children are valid, but in most cases they are not. Unfortunately, we continue to hear of stories of people who respond to email requests for money from another part of the world and are scammed out of their money. For example, an email may read, "Send us $10,000 and we'll send you $50,000. Unbelievably, people actually fall prey to these types of scams. If these types of attacks were not successful, they would cease to exist. If you receive an email that appears to be a hoax, use a search engine to determine whether the email's message is true. For example, if the subject line of the email contains "missing child in some city," for instance, enter text of the subject line in a search engine, adding the word hoax to the end. The result set that you receive will usually indicate whether the email is a hoax. If you receive this type of email at your place of work, report it to your network administrator immediately. It is important to use trusted internet sites to detect hoaxes. Therefore, when you run your search, look for results that are from Snopes or Urban Legends Online, as indicated on this slide, to name two reputable sites. These sites display a picture or an image of the email you received on their site and reveal whether their investigation reveals it to be a hoax. You should never forward email chains, which are typically hoaxes, without verifying their source and identifying them as true. Hackers and how they operate is our next topic of discussion. Hackers are typically people who work to break a computer's security. Sometimes they do it to destroy data or to steal data on a computer. Other hackers just want to break into a computer because they can. One thing that hackers do is employ the use of something called a packet sniffer, which can read internet traffic. Wireshark is a free packet sniffer. It's also known as a protocol analyzer software tool that can display unencrypted network traffic on a screen so that anyone can read it. For example, if a hacker ran a packet sniffer and sniffed the network from which you sent an email, the hacker would be able to see the email that you sent in clear text on their screen. Therefore, if you email usernames and passwords to yourself, or if you store them in email, then a hacker may be able to gain access to them. Hackers like to use information to install malware in the form of adware, which place ads on your screen, an annoyance that makes your computer almost useless, and spyware, which reports on sites that you visit and then perhaps even reports on information that you have stored on your computer. Some hackers try to infiltrate a computer system by guessing usernames and passwords. It is incumbent on us as computer users to never use easy-to-guess passwords such as your name, birth date, pet's name, and so on. Also, you should change default usernames and passwords on wireless routers and on computers so that hackers are unable to easily guess them and gain access to the device. This discussion leads us to the topic of network security. According to Wikipedia, In the field of networking, the specialist area of network security consists of the provisions and policies adopted by the network administrator to prevent and monitor unauthorized access, misuse, modification, or denial of the computer network and network accessible resources. In simpler terms, network security is about the rules that we, both corporate and home network administrators, set up for the use of equipment, software, and data, and our adherence to those rules. The use of computing devices revolves around authentication, authorization, and providing permissions for the use of network assets. In other words, if you cannot validate your identity, then you cannot gain access to the network, its equipment, or its data. We will discuss this in more detail in the following slides. Authentication is essentially the beginning of network security. In an authentication process, a user provides a valid username and password, or credentials. When the user enters their credentials, the computer authenticates the credentials against its user account and password database. In other words, if a user logs in successfully, their credentials match the information in the database and the user is authenticated. Servers typically authenticate users through an Active Directory database, which stores information about all users, user groups, computers, printers, and other objects that are managed by the server. Therefore, an authenticated object, note the term object, is a user with a proven identity, a computer program that a server is able to positively identify, or a server that other devices, servers, computers, printers, etc., are able to positively identify. The next step after authentication is authorization. These terms might seem difficult to grasp at first, but you will become familiar with hearing them. Authorization means that the computer indicates precisely what the user, or, if we want to be more generic, what the object can do. For example, allowing a user to print files using specified printers. Authorization might also include gaining access to specified network drives. For example, if we want to allow users to store files on a server, we would first authenticate and then authorize the users, granting read and write access to a specific network drive. Authorization means that a user may be able to change and/or view documents and folders on a specific drive or use company email. Further, these actions are usually recorded for audit at a later date. This setup indicates that we can prove that we are authenticating and then authorizing users to perform these actions in our network. Corporations, small businesses, and medical facilities may be audited to prove that data is being safeguarded. Failing such an audit might cause a business to lose its license, incur a fine, result in criminal prosecution, or even shut down. Again, note the use of the term objects, which is used often in this discussion, and used interchangeably with the term users. Users, computers, printers, scanners, and other things are referred to as objects in the IT world. In reality, objects are authenticated and authorized on a computer network. Other examples of objects, in addition to what we've mentioned on previous slides, include tables in a database, a text field on a web form, a file, a folder, a hard disk, and more. As a future health informatician, you will use this term quite a bit in future classes and in your everyday work. Let us summarize what we have discussed in the last few slides. One of the first things that we employ to ensure network security is authentication, which is where a user's credentials, which are made up of a username and password, are authenticated. Once a user has been authenticated against the Windows-based computer or server's database, then the user can be authorized. Authorization includes associating the user account or other type of object with permissions. Part of authorizing a user is determining the permissions applicable to that user account, also known as permissioning. Permissions indicate actions an object can or cannot perform on a computer and/or within a network. Two types of permissions are typically used: The first is a sharing permission, which allows one object to connect to or use another object over the network. For example, assume you and your sister each own a computer. On your computer, you store a number of family pictures that you've taken digitally. You decide to create a folder to share the pictures with your sister. From her computer, your sister connects to your computer and then gains access to that shared folder. This is accomplished through sharing permissions. In addition to sharing permissions, for your sister to successfully access the shared folder, the NTFS permissions must be configured. NTFS permissions determine what one object can or cannot do to another object. For example, will you allow somebody to have access to your pictures and then delete them? Or will you only allow that person to view it? Will you allow them to change the picture's name? Will you allow them to add new pictures to your folder? NTFS permissions properly applied to folders and/or files determine whether any of these actions can be performed. NTFS is the new technology file system and applies to all current Windows operating systems. In reality, NTFS is no longer new, as it's been around since approximately 1993. In this discussion of authentication, authorization, and permissions, we have only scratched the surface. Permissions are a complex topic. Sharing and NTFS permissions on a Windows-based computer work together. We will examine how this works in a little more detail. For example, you create a folder on your computer so that your sister can copy pictures stored in that folder. Next, you share the folder and set her sharing permissions to read. Lastly, you set NTFS permissions to read so that she can view and copy pictures. Without this type of a configuration, your sister will not be able to view or copy files from your computer. Examine the partial screenshot of a desktop on this slide, where we see a folder called Pictures in the top left side of the screen. We right-click the folder and select Properties from the context menu that appears to view the window entitled Picture Properties that appears on the right side of the figure. Note that we previously clicked the Share button, which is slightly gray in color, indicating the folder is shared. This is confirmed by the text Pictures Shared to the right of the yellow folder icon in the Pictures Properties dialog box. Clicking the Advanced Sharing button allows the configuration of sharing permissions for this folder. Let us look at some of the detail that's shown here on the screenshot. The name of the computer is John PC. The name of the shared folder is Pictures. With proper configuration, your sister can open this folder by opening any window or browser and typing the following text in the address line. With proper configuration, your sister can open this folder by opening any window or browser and typing the following text in the address line. /John-PC/pictures. The Pictures Properties dialog box is still open. Click the Security tab to configure NTFS permissions. Group or usernames are listed in what is called an Access Control List, or ACL. In the ACL shown is a group or username of administrators, meaning that user accounts that are members of the administrators group on this computer have full control over this folder and its contents. This means that a user who is a member of the Windows Administrators group can do anything to this folder and to its contents. Anything means that they can view, add new files, delete existing files, change file names, and create subfolders. To make changes to the group or usernames listed, click Edit, and then add a new username or group to the Access Control List for this folder.